Okay, thanks, Anne Marie. I'm George Chen. I came to Roswell about 5 years ago after I finished my clinical training in hematology and transplant, and so I've been here since. And if you have any other questions, I can answer them later. But we'll just get started now. So today we're going to talk about clinical hematopoietic cell transplantation. And so the goals for today are to find out what hematopoietic cell transplantation is, and then we will also find out how transplantation is done and how it can be tailored to the patient's disease and circumstances. And so this is a list of the important concepts that you should take away from this lecture. You need to know what the difference is between an autologous and allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant, the difference between a myeloablative and reduced intensity conditioning regimen. You need to be able to know what the genetic differences are between an autologous syngeneic, match-related, match-unrelated, a mismatched, and a haploidentical donor. The difference between acute and chronic graft versus host disease, and then you need to know something about how to interpret donor chimerism, which is the percentage of a patient's blood that consists of donor cells as opposed to their own native cells from before the transplant. Okay. So hematopoietic cell transplant is the transfer of hematopoietic progenitor and stem cells for therapeutic processes. People will refer to it by a bunch of different names on the left. Sometimes people will say bone marrow transplant, hematopoietic stem cell transplant, hematopoietic progenitor cell transplant, and peripheral blood stem cell transplant. Really, these just kind of refer to the actual location of the cells that are harvested, but in the context of this talk, it's all going to be the same. So you don't really need to worry about it, and I'll just refer to it as hematopoietic cell transplant. So this is a diagram of hematopoiesis in humans and in most animals. And so the points to take away are that these are all the cells that are found in the peripheral blood. They include the red blood cells and platelets here, as well as all of the different white blood cells. And what's important is that all of these cells derive from a common multipotential stem cell that is located in the bone marrow. And this is actually the basis for why we can do bone marrow transplants and have reconstitution of hematopoiesis in recipients after the procedure. So we'll go to the first important concept, which is the difference between an autologous and an allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant. Basically, an autologous transplant is a transplant using a patient's own cells for the graft. This is in distinction from an allogeneic transplant, which is a transplant using another person's cells for the graft. So the important point to remember here is which person the cells come from. So a question that sometimes shows up on tests is what kind of transplant is a syngeneic transplant or a transplant from an identical twin? So clinically, when we do a transplant from an identical twin, we treat them just like an autologous hematopoietic cell transplant. But for the sake of being clear about what cells come from what person, a syngeneic transplant is officially defined as an allogeneic transplant because it comes from another person. This is the basic diagram for an autologous hematopoietic cell transplant. So the way it usually goes is that we have a patient who has some sort of malignant disease, which is symbolized by these spiky things. And this patient will undergo the regular chemotherapy that this type of tumor would get, which results in a reduction of the tumor burden in the patient. At the time when the tumor burden is decreased as much as possible, we will usually collect a blood or bone marrow collection from the patient. These cells get frozen away and put into storage. Later on, when the patient is finally ready to come to the transplant, the patient will undergo a conditioning regimen consisting of high-dose chemotherapy. And what happens is that this chemotherapy results in clearing of the bone marrow in the patient, and it also helps and it also destroys any residual disease that may be left over in the patient. The side effect of getting all of this chemotherapy is that all of the bone marrow cells are destroyed. And so this is not a state that is compatible with life. You can't really live without a bone marrow because you don't make any red blood cells to replace the ones that you lose, and you bleed to death because you don't have any platelets and you get infections. So to rescue patients from this state, we will give them back the bone marrow cells that we collected earlier and froze away. These cells go back into the patient just like any regular blood transfusion, and then about 12 or 14 days later, we will see a return of hematopoiesis in the patient. So we will see white blood cells starting to appear in the peripheral blood. And so the important, I wish this would work. Does this work? Oh, it does work. Okay. And so, Okay, and so the important part to know of this is that it's not these cells that you collect and freeze away that are treating the patient's tumor. It's actually this high-dose chemotherapy that does all of the work for us. The side effect of this high-dose chemotherapy is that all of the patient's other healthy bone marrow cells are killed. And so to rescue the patients from this bad side effect of the chemotherapy, we will give them back the bone marrow cells that they collected. This is a dose response curve. And so what it shows is that on this side, as the dose of chemotherapy increases, the amount of cell killing increases. And so this is the kind of tumor that you would treat with an autologous bone marrow transplant. And that goes back to this part here where, you know, it's the chemotherapy that does all the killing. So in a bone marrow transplant, you want to give as much chemotherapy as possible to get as much cell killing as possible. If you have this kind of dose response curve on the right, where maybe there's a little bit of cell killing at a lower dose, and then at a much higher dose, you don't get very much more cell killing. This is the kind of patient's tumor that you do not want to treat with an autologous bone marrow transplant, because in an autologous bone marrow transplant, you give high doses of chemotherapy, so basically at the level of this red line. And so if you were to do that in this kind of patient, you would be wasting all of this extra chemotherapy. It would not be effective in treating the patient's cancer, and you would be exposing your patient to all of the risks from a high dose of chemotherapy without any of the benefits. So these are the indications for an autologous hematopoietic cell transplant. You would do it for diseases in which cytoreduction by chemotherapy is effective and dose dependent. So these include things like germ cell tumors, mostly testicular tumors, large cell lymphomas, and myelomas. And then the other indication for an autologous transplant is the replacement of hematopoiesis, and this is primarily as rescue therapy. This is the basic schema for, does anybody have any other questions about autologous transplantation before I move on? No, okay. So this is the schema for an allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant. It looks very similar to that for an autologous transplant, except that there is the presence of a donor instead of a freezer for the cells. Usually these are patients that have some kind of leukemia. These patients will receive the standard therapy for leukemia, which usually consists of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. This reduces the leukemia tumor burden in the patients. Unfortunately, with standard chemotherapy, you can only reduce the tumor burden so much. There is always a little tiny bit that is left behind that we can't see. So to treat these patients, we will give them high doses of chemotherapy and radiation similar to an autologous bone marrow transplant. This prepares the recipient to receive the donor cells that have been identified previously. It also helps to further reduce the tumor burden in these patients. At the same time, it destroys the recipient's native bone marrow so that when we give the donor cells that have been collected beforehand, there's space for them to go and grow back. They usually grow back over the space of about 2 or 3 weeks. And then with time, these cells eventually fill in all of the hematopoietic spaces in the patient, and they also exert some sort of immunologic effect, hopefully, against any residual leukemia that is left behind in the patient so that this can be gotten rid of over time. So the indications for an allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant are replacement of hematopoiesis, and we also do it in order to cause an immune-mediated effect against the underlying malignancy. This is also called the graft versus tumor effect. And so all of this can also be used to prevent relapse in these leukemia patients. So this is something that you should think about before your exam, and that is to think about what tumor characteristics are amenable to an autologous versus an allogeneic transplant. So are there any takers? No? Okay. No? Okay, so you'll just have to find out the answer on your own then if you're not willing to ask. And so these are the outcomes from an allogeneic bone marrow transplant. And at about 3 or 4 years, so about 20% are alive and well at 3 or 4 years. 15% of patients who undergo an allogeneic transplant will have developed some form of chronic graft versus host disease, but they're still alive. Oops. About 20% will have experienced relapse of their disease. 15% will have died from some form of chronic GVHD. 5% will have died from other random causes. 10% will have died from an infection, and 15% will have died from acute graft versus host disease. So what we're looking at is about 35% of patients who undergo an allogeneic transplant will be alive 3 or 4 years down the line. Everyone else will be dead. And so that sounds really bad, but you have to consider that without a transplant, the overall survival at 3 or 4 years might be as low as 5%. So this is an illustration of that. This is the usual patient with leukemia. They undergo the usual chemotherapy and they have clearance of their bone marrow. And so at this point, patients usually have to decide whether or not they want to go through with a transplant or not. And the reason that they make this decision is that they will inevitably be told by their physicians that they are in a complete remission, that there isn't any leukemia that they can see either microscopically or cytogenetically in their bone marrow. And so they have to think about what the risk of future relapse is. So if they do nothing and they decide to sit and watch, for certain leukemias, there is a 95% chance that the leukemia will come back. And usually when this leukemia comes back, it is resistant to chemotherapy. And that usually results in death if they don't have any other kind of treatment modality available to them. And of these patients, usually only 5% are alive. This will work better, okay. For patients who undergo allogeneic transplant, about 35% will be alive at 3 or 4 years, whereas 65% will have died of some kind of complication of transplant or relapse from their disease. And so if you have to weigh the chance, having a 5% chance of being alive versus a 35% chance of being alive, then most patients will usually choose the 35%, even though they know that the odds are against them ultimately for long-term survival. So So the tricky part is how do you decide which patients will fall into the category for needing a transplant? Because there are certain kinds of leukemias where the overall survival after chemotherapy is as high as 80%. And so people have started to look at genetic mutations in various leukemias to try to predict who will be alive and who will respond well to a transplant. These people looked at the set at NPM1 positive status, and they found that for patients who had a donor and underwent an allogeneic transplant, that these patients had the same survival as patients who did not have a donor. So if you are an NPM1, so if you have NPM1 positive leukemia, then that basically means that doing a transplant does not buy you any extra survival time. And so for that reason, we don't do allogeneic transplants as a first-line therapy in patients who have NPM1 positive disease. In contrast, if you don't have NPM positive disease and you don't receive a transplant, then your survival is quite low. It's as low as about 20% as compared to 35% in patients who do undergo a transplant. So this is similar data, looking at data in the same way. The blue line shows the patients who have received an allogeneic transplant, and the black line is those patients who did not receive an allogeneic transplant. And the patients who are shown in this graph are patients who had a relapse after initially being put into a complete remission by chemotherapy. So if you relapse after chemotherapy, that is a very bad very bad prognostic factor, because basically what that tells you is that your leukemia is somehow resistant to chemotherapy and that additional chemotherapy is not going to do any more good. So for that reason, if you get an allogeneic transplant, then your survival increases all the way up to about 45% as compared to 5% if you don't get a transplant. Okay. So that's autologous versus allogeneic transplants. Does anybody have any questions? No. So MUD stands for a matched unrelated donor, which is essentially an allogeneic transplant. Okay, so the next important topic is a myeloablative versus a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. This is the basic schema for an allogeneic transplant. The conditioning regimen that is referred to is here, and this would be considered, in this diagram, it's a myeloablative transplant or a high-dose chemotherapy transplant. I previously alluded to the fact that for an allogeneic transplant, we wanted to take advantage of the immunologic effects of the graft. And so there are two main effects. The first is called a graft versus tumor effect, and this is the reaction of the donor's immune system against the recipient's malignancy. And then the other effect is the graft versus host effect, and this is the reaction of the donor's immune system against the recipient's body tissues. And so these are actually two sides of the same coin. And that's shown in this picture. This is a graph of the probability of relapse after a matched related allogeneic transplant for leukemia. And these survival curves are separated by the amount of graft versus host disease that was observed after these patients had transplants. So in this top curve, the twins, these were syngeneic twins, and they had the least amount of graft versus host disease. The next curve down is transplants that were done using T-cell depletion, and so they have a little bit more graft versus host disease. There's these are patients who got the normal transplant who did not have any graft versus host disease, and then finally down here are the patients who had a lot of graft versus host disease. And so what we see is that the more graft versus host disease you have, the less likely you are to relapse from your leukemia. And so basically that shows us that there is a link between graft versus host disease and graft versus host effects and graft versus tumor effects, and that these allogeneic grafts have some sort of immune-mediated effect that is exerted on the leukemia. So these are more dose response curves. And so we are familiar with this. We saw this when we talked about when we talked about autologous transplants, where the more chemotherapy you got, the more cell killing you got. And so what I didn't show you at that time was how much toxicity accompanied the chemotherapy that was received. So this is the usual relationship that we see, which is that the more chemotherapy you get, the more patient toxicity you will see. This is the dose response curve for a different kind of tumor. And what we see is that this is the kind of tumor that would not be amenable to an autologous transplant, because even though you give a higher dose of chemotherapy, you don't see any additional cell killing. So what do you think would be the toxicity curve for this kind of patient? Any takers? So do you think you would see a curve that's similar to this curve, where, just because you don't have very much cellular response to a higher dose, that also means that your patient is not going to have very much more toxicity? Or do you think that you'll see a curve similar to this, where even though you don't get a response, you get more toxicity? Like this one? Like this one. Okay. Yeah, so that's basically what we see. Even though at higher doses of chemotherapy there isn't much more cell killing, we will still see increased patient toxicity. And so when they first started doing transplants, they would always, especially for leukemia, they would always give high doses of chemotherapy. And after a while, they began to realize that even though they would keep giving tons and tons of chemotherapy, they didn't see any real improvement in the survival curve. So they kind of guessed that this was probably what was happening in myeloablative allogeneic transplants for leukemia. So at that time, they had also seen this data, where they knew that there was also a immunologic effect that was caused by the allogeneic graft against the leukemia. So they thought that perhaps they could take advantage of this. And what they wanted to do turned out to be what we now call a reduced intensity allogeneic bone marrow transplant. And so in this kind of transplant, we have a patient with leukemia, and they go through their regular therapy, and they have reduction of the tumor burden to this tiny little bit here. But instead of doing the high doses of chemotherapy, they tried to give just enough chemotherapy to knock out some of these cells and maybe reduce some of this leukemia here, but mostly to allow the recipient to be able to receive the donor cells without rejecting them. So this was more of an immunosuppressive regimen as opposed to a myeloablative regimen. And what happened was that when they would give the donor cells, these donor cells would come in. You wouldn't have total ablation of the recipient's bone marrow. You would still have some left over. And so for the period of about 1 to 3 months, you would have what's called a chimera, which would basically mean that there were recipient bone marrow cells mixed in with donor bone marrow cells, and that over time, the donor bone marrow cells would exert their immunologic effects and get rid of any residual leukemia, and then eventually your patient would be cured. So basically, this is a myeloablative allogeneic bone marrow transplant that is done in slow motion instead of, you know, instead of replacing everything over the space of about a week, the bone marrow would be slowly replaced by the donor cells over the space of 1 to 3 months. This is how they were able to do it. And they were able to do it by changing around the chemotherapy drugs that they used in their transplantation regimens. So these regimens would have been used in this slot right here to condition the patient. So this is a list of some commonly used regimens. Over here are the myeloablative regimens. And so this is important to note that all of the autologous transplant regimens are myeloablative because you wouldn't, you know, that's the entire point of an autologous transplant is to be able to tolerate high doses of chemotherapy. And so things like cyclophosphamide and total body irradiation, busulfan and cyclophosphamide and melphalan given as a single agent. And then over on this side are the reduced intensity and non-myeloablative regimens. So these are mostly regimens that cause immunosuppression so that the recipient does not reject the donor cells. And if you have a reduced intensity regimen, then you have some cytoreduction, but not to the extent of a myeloablative transplant. And so basically this takes advantage of that kind of plateaued dose response curve where you got some response at a low dose, but not much more at a high dose. You're only giving the amount of chemotherapy that you need to get the cells in and to exert and to clean up what you can from the leukemia. So this is another way of looking at the differences between myeloablation versus reduced intensity. So this is, you know, this is your patient that has a normal bone marrow, and then they go through chemotherapy. And so with a myeloablative regimen, everything is burned to the ground. And if you don't do anything else, months later, you still have nothing, and then you die. With a reduced intensity regimen, you have some reduction in the cellularity of the bone marrow. There are still some cells left behind, so that after about a few months, you actually still have recovery of your bone marrow. And so this is not good in leukemia because that basically means that your leukemia comes back if you don't do anything. So that's why in this slot, we would give donor cells to replace the native cells with healthy cells that can also get rid of the leukemia. Why did I put this here? Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, so this is hematopoiesis. We've seen this before. And so now we're going to talk about why it is that different chemotherapy drugs result in either myeloablation or some preservation of hematopoiesis. And this is the diagram that you've seen before, and here are the magic stem cells that we like. So for myeloablative regimens, they almost always contain some busulfan, melphalan, or TBI. And the TBI here stands for total body irradiation, and the dose that is myeloablative is somewhere around 1200 to 1400 centigrades. And the reason that these are myeloablative, they basically burn everything to the ground and they don't let anything recover, is because in addition to killing all of these other things, they also target the hematopoietic stem cell. So basically, if you kill this off, it's basically like cutting things off at the root. Nothing grows back afterwards. With regard to the other agents, one of the most common agents that we use in a reduced intensity regimen is fludarabine. And the reason that it does not cause myeloablation is because it only affects the lymphoid branch of the hematopoietic tree. It does not affect this hematopoietic stem cell. So you can give huge amounts of fludarabine and you'll have reduction in the lymphocytes, but you know this stays alive and healthy, and over time this will grow back and you know eventually become more lymphocytes. And so the same thing happens for a drug like cyclophosphamide. Cyclophosphamide is very good at reducing all of these later cells, but it does not affect the hematopoietic stem cell, even at very high doses. So if you just give a patient a high dose of cyclophosphamide, you get rid of all of these cells, but you keep the cell alive and going. Okay, so this is clinical data that was reported in 2012 by Bornhauser, and what this was a randomized clinical trial comparing reduced intensity conditioning versus myeloablative conditioning for patients with acute myeloid leukemia in first complete remission. So these are basically patients that got chemotherapy, and then when they repeated the bone marrow biopsy afterwards, they did not see any evidence for leukemia. So as clean as you could get. And then all these patients received allogeneic transplants. They either received a match-related donor or they received a 9 out of 10 HLA-matched unrelated donor. And so the blue curves are the myeloablative, or the patients that received a myeloablative conditioning regimen, and the red curves are the patients that received a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. And so if we look at the non-relapse mortality, and so this is basically death from any cause except for relapse, we see that there is a little bit more non-relapse mortality with the standard regimen, which makes sense because we know that if you get a myeloablative regimen, you get more patient toxicity, so that's where that shows up. If we look at relapse, we see this very interesting curve. And basically, these curves are right on top of each other, and that tells us that there's no statistical difference in terms of whether or not patients relapse after a reduced intensity versus a myeloablative regimen. And that, you know, I believe is mostly due to this graft versus tumor effect that you get from having an allogeneic bone marrow graft. If we look at overall survival, this is disease-free survival. This is about the same, maybe a little bit better for reduced intensity. And if we look at overall survival, this is again about the same. So what we can tell from this is that when you get a reduced intensity regimen, it's less toxic on your body, but the survival is just as good as for a myeloablative regimen. And so if you have a population that is at very high risk for developing toxicity after transplant, such as in an elderly population, like a 65-year-old versus an 18-year-old, then that would make you favor using a reduced intensity conditioning regimen to do your transplant with. And so we actually see that. The authors actually present that data as well. This is, once again, looking at non-relapse mortality. This is all patients who are on the trial. We see that there is less non-relapse mortality with the reduced intensity compared with the myeloablative regimen. So we saw this in the previous slide. If we stratify these patients according to their age range, and we look at the 18 to 40-year-olds, we see that these curves are right on top of each other. So basically, if you're 18 to 40, it's not going to matter whether or not you get a myeloablative or a reduced intensity regimen. You suffer about the same amount of toxicity because when you're younger, you have more reserve to tolerate bad things that happen to you in the course of treatment. If you're older, look at this huge difference. This is the myeloablative arm, and this is the reduced intensity arm. You see so much less toxicity with the reduced intensity conditioning regimen. So those are the main differences between a myeloablative versus a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. And so now I'll talk a little bit about hypoplastic allogeneic transplants. And so this is a schema that we've seen before. This is a patient with leukemia. He gets chemotherapy. Usually they have reduction in the tumor mass. And then what happens to these patients is that, over time, if you don't give more chemotherapy or if you don't do more chemotherapy, then their leukemia slowly grows back, as does their bone marrow. So in order to keep them in this stage, leukemia doctors will continue to give cycles of consolidation chemotherapy to their patients even after induction chemotherapy has pretty much cleared their bone marrow of disease. So where we usually put the timing of an allogeneic transplant is sometime, well, usually we have to have a donor in order to do a transplant. So once we find a donor, then we'll do the transplant, and then the patient is eventually cured. So there is a subset of leukemia patients where the leukemia just grows back very rapidly. And so, you know, whereas this might be a cycle of about a month, these patients that have very bad leukemia have rapid regrowth early. And so the problem with having rapid regrowth is that it's very difficult to properly do an allogeneic transplant when there's that much disease. It's just the donor cells are just overwhelmed by all of the leukemia that's in the patient's body, and you know, you have relapse and the patient doesn't do well. So to get around this, what we've done here at Roswell is that we've changed the timing of the transplant from the usual time, which is about 3 or 4 months after induction, to a much earlier time point. So right after induction chemotherapy, before the leukemia has had a chance to regrow. And so you would give the cells at this point, and then the patient would hopefully recover and be cured. Okay. So here's something to think about. What tumor characteristics are amenable to myeloablative versus reduced intensity conditioning allogeneic transplant? And then also, what tumor characteristics do you think would be amenable to hypoplastic allogeneic transplantation? Anybody? Nope. Okay. All right. So the next important concept that we'll move on to are the various donor sources for a hematopoietic cell transplant. The donor source reflects the purpose of the cells. So if you use an autologous donor source, the main purpose is for rescue hematopoiesis. You can also get this with an allogeneic transplant. And then with regard to immune therapy, you would usually use an allogeneic donor source. So there is some evidence that an autologous donor source can also generate immune-mediated effects against your underlying malignancy. And so that's shown in this diagram here. This was a study of patients who had acute leukemia who received, well, I guess it's technically not an autologous transplant, but they received a syngeneic bone marrow transplant. And so what they found was that if you gave these patients a very high dose of cells, that their overall survival was much better than if you gave them a lower dose. Okay. So we'll talk about HLA, and this is also known as the major histocompatibility complex. And so these are proteins that are on the surface of almost all of the cells in your body, and they are also the most important transplant. Their normal function is to present antigen to T cells, and these are the proteins that are responsible for graft rejection and for graft versus host disease. So you don't really need to know that, but what you do need to know is that there is a high degree of polymorphism in the MHC locus. We usually look at 10 loci for HLA, but I've only shown 4 here, and you can see that you know there are 400 alleles for the DRB1 loci, 370 for A, 660 for B, 190 for C, and then 62 for DQB1. So if these all kind of recombine independently, then that results in more than this huge number of combinations. So there really aren't that many combinations in the world. It's actually a smaller number because not everything is as independent as people say. But you know, you can, if you know, if we are determining allogeneic donors based on HLA matching, then you can easily imagine how it might be difficult to find a patient that has, to find a donor that has the same HLA type as you. This is the way that HLA is inherited. You get one haplotype from each parent, and so you have 50% of one haplotype and 50% of another, and so that basically means that you have a 25% chance of having the same haplotype as your siblings. So this is an equation that we use to calculate the likelihood of finding a matched sibling among your siblings, and so that's useful to know. Okay, so this is a figure showing the genetic differences between donors. So when we do typing for a matched unrelated donor, we look at DR, BAC, and DQ. For match-related donors, typing is usually on DR, B, and A. So we assume that these are the same for siblings. A haploidentical donor is basically a donor that shares one haplotype with you. And so this would be either your mom or your dad. Usually your brothers and sisters will share a haplotype with you. And we only need matching at half of the loci. A syngeneic transplant is basically the same at all of the loci, and an autologous transplant is the same as all of the loci. So these are the same, and then outside of the MHC are the minor histocompatibility antigens, and you know, sometimes you will share this with your donor. It's usually not there in a matched unrelated donor, but in a match-related donor, you will share some of the MHC molecules, and then for haplotype, you will have half. Okay. So with regard to donor selection, we usually look at a few factors. We look at HLA matching, relatedness. We'll look at cytomegalovirus status, age, gender, which is mostly related to how many children you have. And then we usually don't look, we usually don't worry about matching the ABO blood type, because these will change over after the transplant has fully set in, but this is always an area of debate. Okay, so now we'll talk about acute versus chronic graft versus host disease. So, you know, this is kind of how we feel. You know, we'll have patients who we think we're rescuing from the problem of having leukemia by doing a transplant, but sometimes as a result of the transplant, we cause a great deal of graft versus host disease. So, you know, sometimes the problem is just as bad as having leukemia. Okay, we talked about this before, and we've seen this before. So in the 1960s, Bill Billingham proposed some criteria for when acute graft versus host disease would occur. And so acute graft versus host disease is basically the reaction of the donor's immune system against the recipient's body tissue, and it will present as diarrhea, skin rash, liver test abnormalities, all usually within the first 100 days. And so anywhere from 20 to 50% of allogeneic transplants will develop some acute GVHD, and the associated mortality is anywhere from 15 to 20%. And so in the 1960s, Bill Billingham proposed some conditions for which he thought that acute GVHD would be most likely to occur. And he proposed that in order for it to occur, your graft had to have immunologically competent cells. So in other words, they had to be alive and active and able to detect differences from their own self. The second criteria was that the host had to have had to have antigens that weren't present in the donor. So basically, the donor would see these antigens as being different and would then be capable of being stimulated by them to attack those antigens. And then finally, the third criteria was that the host or the recipient could not be able to reject the donor cells, because if they were able to be rejected, then you know there wouldn't be any donor cells to cause graft versus host disease. So we address acute GVHD in two ways. One is by using prophylaxis, so we try to prevent it from developing, and then the other is by actively treating it once it has occurred. And methods of prophylaxis include pharmacologics. So typically we will give the combination of a calcineurin inhibitor and methotrexate after transplant. Sometimes in other centers, they will deplete the T cells which cause the acute graft versus host disease, either ex vivo using a CD34 selection device, or in vivo using anti-thymocyte globulin or anti-CD52 antibody. And then finally, there's this very interesting way of preventing acute GVHD by giving high doses of cyclophosphamide after transplant. So this just kind of shows the relative merits of T-cell depletion versus pharmacologic approaches to acute GVHD. Overall, these are about the same. So we'll skip that. Okay, so we'll get to high-dose cyclophosphamide. So this is a very interesting way of preventing acute graft versus host disease. And so basically what happens is that patients will receive a conditioning regimen consisting of fludarabine, a lower dose of cyclophosphamide, and total body irradiation here, and then they will get their cells. And then after they have gotten their donor cells, they will get a much higher dose of cyclophosphamide on days 3 and 4. And so just so that you have a better idea of when these events happen, this is the same reduced intensity conditioning schema that we've looked at. The conditioning regimen happens right there, and then the cell infusion occurs right there, and then finally the high doses of cyclophosphamide occur after the donor cells have been given to the patient. So this is a bit of a paradox, because I just got through telling you that cyclophosphamide is used in the conditioning regimen to basically reduce the native hematopoiesis as well as potentially any leukemia load in the bone marrow of the recipient. And now I've told you that we also give it post-transplant. So, what keeps the cyclophosphamide that we give after transplant from destroying the graft that we've just given you? Because it seems like, we give chemotherapy and then we give more chemotherapy. How is it possible for these donor cells to survive in the patient? And so I think what we should do is we should look at how the high-dose cyclophosphamide works to prevent acute graft versus host disease. So this is these are the mature T cells that come over from the donor. That come over for the donor and that have gone into the recipient at day 0. And so when they go into the recipient, they encounter all sorts of antigens, and sometimes the T cells won't encounter an antigen in the patient's body, but sometimes they will. And so if they don't encounter an antigen, then they kind of, they're okay. They stay at rest, they don't bother anything. But if they do encounter an antigen that corresponds to their T cell receptor, then these T cells become very activated. And when they become activated, they become preferentially sensitive to cyclophosphamide, which is given at days 3 or 4. And when we give them the cyclophosphamide, then these T lymphocytes are destroyed. They undergo apoptosis. Meanwhile, these lymphocytes that didn't become active are left alone. And so these are the lymphocytes that remain in the patient after the high-dose cyclophosphamide on days 3 and 4. So this right here, you know, this reaction of these T cells against antigens in the body is basically why we think that the cyclophosphamide prevents graft versus host disease, because this is essentially graft versus host disease. This is the graft reacting against these antigens in the patient's body, whether they be in the skin or liver or the gut. So does anybody have questions on how that works? No? Okay. So, you know, so this is something that is important. And, you know, I would encourage you to look at this and to think about how Billingham's hypothesis explains how post-transplant cyclophosphamide prevents acute graft versus host disease. And then I would also think about what properties cyclophosphamide has that enables its use after transplant without endangering the graft. Any takers? Once, twice? No? Okay. Okay, so the other thing that we have to talk about is chronic graft versus host disease. This is similar to acute graft versus host disease, except that the symptoms are different, as opposed to rash in the skin and elevated liver tests and diarrhea. The typical symptoms are fibrotic skin disease, dry and gritty mouth and eyes due to glandular destruction, and sometimes gastrointestinal fibrosis with malnutrition. And usually these symptoms usually occur about 100 days after the transplant, although sometimes we see it occur earlier. 50% of long-term survivors will develop some form of chronic graft versus host disease. And other than relapse, chronic graft versus host disease is actually the major cause of long-term mortality in some form or another. You know, very rarely it's from the actual symptoms of chronic graft versus host disease, because, you know, if you have kind of dry skin, you can live with that, and you can live with dry eyes or a dry mouth. Sometimes if you have dry eyes, you go blind, but you can still be living and doing okay with that. But what happens is that we give a lot of immunosuppressive treatments for chronic graft versus host disease. And so in the course of all this immunosuppression, a lot of the patients will develop infections, which ultimately turn out to be lethal. Okay, so these are examples of patients with chronic graft versus host disease. You know, they basically look, so they're not all this bad. But in very bad cases, these patients look like burn patients. This patient's skin is all very tight and fibrotic, and it looks like this patient is not giving his full effort to lifting his arms above his shoulders, but that's actually as far as he can lift it because of the contractures that have developed from the skin tightness. These are similar manifestations, and then you can see this sort of lichenification in the mouth that causes dry mouth. Okay. So the next concept that we'll discuss is donor chimerism. That's what a chimera is, but that's okay. And so, you know, we talked about this before in the setting of a reduced intensity conditioning regimen, where there is coexistence of recipient bone marrow and recipient cells and donor cells in the same patient. And so that's this sort of situation. And typically it occurs early in a reduced intensity conditioning regimen transplant. So over time, this should convert to full donor chimerism, which basically means that all of your blood cells come from the donor. In terms of how the data comes back to us, they will send a percentage of the bone marrow cells that are donor versus recipient, and we consider anything above or equal to 95% donor to be full donor chimerism. If you develop a state of mixed donor chimerism, then there are various ways to convert it to full donor chimerism. You can do things like give a donor lymphocyte infusion, or you can do something like remove immunosuppression. Okay, so we'll do some practice questions. You finally finished your training, and now you have your first job. I know it took forever, but, you know, life happens eventually. Eventually, sometimes it takes us 20 years, but that's okay. And, you know, you're incredibly lucky, and you identify a new deadly form of blood cancer your first week. And so it has the following growth curve. And so this is cell survival on the y-axis, chemotherapy dose on the x-axis, and basically you have less survival of this deadly cancer with more chemotherapy. So, you know, your boss asks you what transplant options you would offer to your patient. Anybody? Yeah? Sorry? Right. Yeah, exactly. So you would give an autologous transplant because with an autologous transplant, you can give high doses of chemotherapy, so you can push the cell survival all the way out to here. And because with an autologous transplant, you get rescue hematopoiesis, your patient won't die from the bad side effects of a chemotherapy. So what kind of chemotherapy regimen would you choose? You don't have to give specific drug names, but just kind of in general, low dose, medium dose, no dose, high dose, myeloablative, reduced intensity. I'm sorry? Right, so you give a myeloablative dose because, you know, that the myeloablative dose is a high dose of chemotherapy and it destroys all of the stem cells as well. Okay. So maybe you're not so lucky because you accidentally inoculate yourself with the cancer and it starts growing. And even worse, it mutates and now it has this survival curve. You know, lucky for you, it seems kind of antigenic and maybe amenable to an immune response. So what are your transplant options now? Right, so you would try an allogeneic because, you know, you can get an immune-mediated effect. And would you give a myeloablative or would you give a reduced intensity conditioning regimen? Sorry? Right, you would give a reduced intensity because, you know, a reduced intensity gives kind of this, well, let's say it gives this level of dosing as opposed to this level. You know, this would be a myeloablative, this would be reduced intensity, and so giving a myeloablative doesn't really make any sense because you don't get much more benefit as compared to reduced intensity. And then, you know, we've also seen real-life clinical data that overall survival is about the same and that there is reduced toxicity. Okay, so you have two siblings. What are your chances of finding a match-related donor? And so I have to do this myself. Sorry, I didn't calculate this before I came. Anybody? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, about 44%. Okay. And so that's based on that equation, the 1 minus 0.75 to the nth power, where the nth power represents the number of sibling donors that you could have. So, yeah, so two siblings. Okay. Okay, so we have a special guest. This is Mary Rose McDermott,
So, can you hear me? I think it's important that you hear a little bit of where my case started and how I got to a transplant so you can understand the process that I went through as a patient. I was 29 years old, so not much older, I'm guessing, than some of you. I was also 4 months pregnant when I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, which I'm sure you all know is cancer of your lymph system. So thank goodness Roswell Park is literally 10 minutes from my house if you drive through every red light, I found out one day. And my doctor, I was lucky enough, immediately referred me here also, because I've heard so many horror stories about people that are out in the community and they get bounced around and they have a million tests. But I walked into his office one day and I said to him, I have this kind of large mass under my arm that I don't remember being there the day before. And I actually wasn't seeing my regular OBGYN, I was seeing his substitute because he was on vacation. And he said, as a woman, you have a lot of changes when you're pregnant, and especially in the breast area. So he said, it just could be an infection. We'll give you some antibiotics. 10 days later, if you see no change, make sure you call your regular OB back and make sure, you come in to see him. 10 days go by, absolutely nothing happens. I'm still like, no big deal. And so I called him and I said, I still got this thing. And he says, come right in. And I did. And he took one look at me and he says, I think you might have a lymphoma. And I was thinking, not really sure what that is, but sounds like we're good to go. He says, I want you to get it out, see what it is, and we'll take it from there. So I went to see a surgeon, and he, again, says we need to get it out. And so he scheduled me for about a week later. This all moved along pretty quickly. And a couple of days before that surgery, I actually went and itched my neck, and now there was like 3 or 4 little tiny pebbles I could feel. And at that point, I said, I think this is really serious. So I walked into the surgery, it was an outpatient, and I said to the surgeon, now I got all these little ones here, what are we going to do? And he said, I think you have Hodgkin's disease. And my first thought was Mario Lemieux, who played for the Pittsburgh Penguins, had just finished his treatment of radiation. I thought, well, how bad could that be? He's back playing hockey. So he took out a small one, and the very next day my GYN called me and says, it's definitely Hodgkin's disease, he says, and I'm sending you to Roswell Park. And so I think the bomb kind of hit me that, I have cancer. And he said to me, the only thing I can tell you is whatever they want to do for the baby, I will do. And so that's how I walked in here one day, bright sunny day in the fall. And I was given a wonderful physician and found out many years later that Dr. Block actually diagnosed my case. And so I had stage 2, they felt, Hodgkin's lymphoma. They did not want to do a whole lot of staging because the physician felt at the time my treatment would be the same for you. And he laid out 3 plans. The first plan was he would have liked to start with radiation. I had a very large chest mass on my chest. And he felt, first of all, he couldn't understand why I wasn't having trouble breathing, which I was not. So he wanted to reduce that tumor and then put me into chemotherapy. But I would have had to terminate the pregnancy. They would not give me radiation while I was pregnant. The second option was start with chemotherapy. He was willing to give it to me while I was pregnant, which is amazing because they tell you, do not take an aspirin when you are pregnant unless you call the doctor first. And he says, we'll just start you on this plan and we will just take it as it goes. Or the third option he did point blankly tell me was that if I did not do any treatment, that I would not make it to the end of the pregnancy or with the baby. So it kind of seemed like a no-brainer, and we said, let's try chemotherapy and we'll take it from there. So I was put on an ABVD regimen. I was given chemotherapy every 2 weeks. At the same time, I started to see a specialist at Children's for the baby, and we just kept monitoring it along that way. I got through 4 months of chemotherapy when my oncologist felt that he only liked to give it in month cycles. I'm not sure the reason. I'm sure Dr. Chen would be able to explain that piece. But we got to 4 months of chemo, and he said, I'd like to deliver the baby because we can pick a good time when you feel good. And Children's Hospital was willing to induce me. And so we picked a date. We had the baby, and he was born perfectly healthy. He now is a student at the University of North Carolina. Dr. Block is a wonderful mentor to him, and he would like to go on to graduate school to do cancer research, like many of you here. And after I finished treatment, I did 2 more rounds of chemotherapy. I opted to do 5 weeks of radiation because I felt that would give me the best percentage to keep the disease into remission, and I went on my merry way. No quote, because my name's Mary. And I went, came in here every 3 months for a gallium scan, which they do not even do anymore, thank God. It's a very toxic test. And every time my tests came back perfectly clean. So I was told by my physician that when you reach 5 years for Hodgkin's disease, that you pretty much reach the golden bar there, that you know we don't really worry so much about you getting Hodgkin's anymore. We start to watch for some other types of cancers. I got to about 4.5 years, and I started to have a couple of issues, nothing major. But then I started to itch, which I remember to be a very big symptom the first time I had presented with Hodgkin's disease. And so for my regular four-month checkup, I walked into the oncologist's office and said, and he says, "How are you?" And I says, "I'm starting to itch, which I don't like." And he said, "Well, let's go look at your CAT scan." And he comes running back down the hall and said, "Yeah, I see a shadow that I don't like." And so a biopsy of the lung area showed that I had Hodgkin's disease for a second time, which was unusual in this case was that it was the exact same Hodgkin's disease. Normally, the exact same type, from what I understand, will come back within a 2-year time frame, meaning that it was never really wiped out to begin with, or if it comes back at a later time, that it is morphed into a different type of Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's, which I know was a little bit more difficult to cure. So he said, "I was lucky that I got the Hodgkin's back, I guess. Unlucky that he felt that the best cure for me was a transplant." So I have to back up and tell you the first time I was diagnosed with cancer, I used to always run through all my options, and I would say to him, "Okay, so if the ABVD doesn't work, what do? He goes, "You go on to MOP." And I said, "Okay, that's good." And I says, "What if the MOP doesn't work?" And he said, "Then you go right to transplant. That's your last-ditch effort." So 4 years later, 4.5 years, when I actually had a new oncologist, I said, "What do you mean you're sending me to transplant? You know, I was under the understanding that's the last-ditch effort." And he said, "Absolutely not." He goes, "We have perfected this. This is the first choice of treatment for you." So here's a question, and somebody better answer. I do not have graft versus host disease, so what kind of transplant did I have? Thank you. I had an auto transplant. So I actually went in. I did one. I didn't have a lot of disease. There wasn't a lot of disease that they had to give chemotherapy for. I did one round of chemotherapy. They did the apheresis process where they took out my stem cells. They froze them in the freezer, which as a patient, that scares you. Where do you put them, and are they going to come back to me? I have to tell you that. They froze them in the freezer, and then at the beginning of May in 1999, I came here as a patient to start the transplant process. And as Dr. Chen explained, the hardest part is getting through that week-long chemotherapy. It's very daunting. It's very takes a lot out of you, and I guess for me the very hardest part was to be stuck in a little tiny hospital room for an entire week and you can't leave the room for many reasons, and I understand all that, but that part is very difficult. But as a patient too, some of the things that he touched upon in order to make the process easier is all of the other additional changes that you have to make in your life, such as you don't want to come in contact with someone that's sick, which seems obvious to yourself, but to everyone else, you're trying to back away and don't come into my room and don't touch me and different things like that. And then the other piece was your diet and making sure that you had a neutropenic diet, that you weren't intaking any germs or things through what you were eating. But after a week of the chemotherapy, I made it through that, and they brought back the little bag and they hung it on the thing, and it has to be the most anticlimactic part of the transplant, which you think you build up to that piece, but you don't. Hung the bag, dripped it in, and they made me sit there a couple of days, and then I was such a pain about getting out of the hospital. Every day the doctor would come in and I would say, "When can I go home? When can I go home?" And he originally told me he felt that after 3 weeks I would be able to go home. And don't forget, now I have a 4-year-old at home, and I really wanted to go home. So my plan was, I can do the 3 weeks, but every day, when can I home? When can I home? When can I go home? He walks into my room 2 weeks later. I have no white count. I have nothing. And he says, "I think you can go home." And I'm like, "Oh, my God." So he sent me home, no white count, nothing. under the stipulation that I came back to the hospital every day as an outpatient, basically. They actually admitted me to a little room. They would give me fluids. I would see the doctor. I would do everything that they would do while you were, you know, as a patient in the hospital. And it would take a good 5 to 6 hours, but then I could get up and I could go home. And after about 2 weeks after that, I started to really rebound on my white count and all of my other cell counts. So overall, I made it through quite easily. I did have an issue with pneumonitis later down the line. A couple weeks later, my lungs had become inflamed, but steroids were able to take care of that. And now it's been over 15 years, so it's an amazing process, life-saving for many, many people, and you can definitely get through and walk away and get back to a regular quality of life. After that, I decided that, you know, I really needed to work here, so I do work at Roswell Park in the Alliance Foundation, raising money for researchers and patient care programs here. Any questions? I'll answer anything, and somebody better have a question. My husband, number one, he really, he's an accountant, so he's very regimented and really kept everything in order, which is a lot as a patient. I never been able to do it myself mentally. When they sent me home, I said it was fabulous. I could go home. I went home, I swear, with a shoebox full of medications and just keeping track of, you know, this one's 3 times a day, this one's 4 times a day. You know, he literally had a little chart and would call me and said, take two, you know, take one of A and two of B, and you know, I mean, so it was a lot to keep track of. So him and also my son was really kind of the reason that got me through, I think. Anything else?
Have you had any side effects from the autologous transplant?
Yes. So fortunately, Roswell Park runs a long-term survivor clinic. I know I've seen you in clinic. The parameters I know have changed throughout the years. I even originally for an auto transplant, they first told me you don't need to get revaccinated. You've gotten your vaccines back. And then a couple years later, they decided the standards had changed and they needed to re-vaccinate me like a child. So literally, you know, it was going like every couple of months, like when you have a baby and getting revaccinated. So there's been a lot of things that they have been following for me. I do have a very low immune system, so I'm very still cautious about being around people that are sick, about getting overtired and things like that. So I'm very protective of trying to keep myself healthy. I did have a residual effect from, they feel, although, you know, it's not absolutely positive, from the radiation the first time. So I was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years ago. So, and there's other cancers that they watch for now all the time. So that is a result of having the transplant, but I wouldn't give up the last 15 years for any of that. I mean, it's just something that you have to live with. What have we missed? You want to know about right around the transplant or you know, after everything was done? Okay, so during the transplant, it's difficult because, number one, the neutropenic diet is challenging. And, for example, fresh fruits and vegetables, which everyone thinks is the most healthiest thing, they're dirty. You can't get them clean, all of that. Water, you had to, even bottled water isn't good enough. You had to boil it. So there was a lot of really particular, there wasn't a lot I could eat, let's put it that way. Everything had to be cooked to extremely well done, you know, so it didn't have any germs. So that part was challenging, and thankfully somebody came to live with us that actually kind of took care of that. So when you're going through a transplant, you almost need multiple people to handle all these different aspects of what's going on in your life. But you know, you got to get through it. So I mean, you just bear down and know that this is what has to happen afterwards. I think, you know, it's just a part of my life now. So it's just a new normal for me. So I don't think about it on a daily basis. It's just kind of the way I live my life.
Can you garden?
Can I garden? Yes, but now that I've had the, actually, I no issues up to recently, but the breast cancer now I have to wear just gloves to make sure. I have to be very careful of my hands and cuts and things like that. Why'd you ask that? Dirty? I couldn't garden during the transplant. I remember that. I got yelled at one day. Anything else? No, it's only during the transplant when you're really at your lowest. So I would say it went for about 2-3 months. Yeah. So after that, you once your white count started to come up, they started to say you can do this, you can do this. So you start adding things back in, which I was very happy about. Being stuck in the room. I mean, I'll be honest, it just is. I can't help it. You know, you used to, and you know, you're stuck in the hospital. You think of your day, you go outside, you go here, you know, and you're just stuck in that little room. And I think, I know a lot of people are really sick, so that doesn't bother them. And I've heard other patients I've come in contact with say that, oh, I was so sick, I never got out of bed. For me, I wasn't that sick, you know, and I got up and walked the floor every day, so I felt really confined. I think that was the hardest part. Yeah, 1999. I know you have to keep the door closed.
Yeah.
Because I used to keep my door open all the time. I used to drive the nurses crazy.
I mean, the, I guess, it's still basically the same. You know, you still get chemotherapy, and then you have your bone marrow cells harvested, frozen away, and you still get conditioning, myeloablative conditioning regimen, and then you get your cells, and then there's that recovery period. So, you know, sometimes maybe I think they've made the entire fifth floor of the hospital like one air filter unit. I'm not sure if that was there.
That was there. No, you could walk out on the floor. Thank God. So that's good.
And then
I think we've gotten better. If I can, patient programs, like really trying to engage the patient and. People come up to the floor, so I think a lot of that has improved.
You
have the internet. There was no internet back then, people. I mean, there was nothing. I mean, you had VHS tapes, you know, so there's probably a little bit more to do now. Well, you know, that would probably be the case.
So there are more things to kind of
distract you. Yeah.
You
could do that, but you couldn't then, so that was hard.
Now, even locally, for a patient who lived a distance away, they have to stay
in Buffalo. For an auto until day 28 or day 30.
So I don't know if you guys are familiar with Home Lodge. You have a guest house. These are places where people stay. A great opportunity to volunteer, by the way.
Yeah, that must be a godsend because, you know, I know your family has to come with you and, you know, like I said, you're bored. You want people to come. You know, my husband used to come visit at night. My mother used to come. We used to play cards all the time. You know, so you want some distraction there. I would say it mentally it's, I think in any cancer patient, once you've been diagnosed and you get so far out, you start to not think about it every day. You know, it's not the forefront of your mind. So when you relapse or, you know, it was diagnosed with breast cancer later on, again, it brings it to that forefront that you have to be really mindful and watchful and sometimes makes you feel a little bit different than everyone else. But, you know, other than that, you know that eventually you'll get to a point again where you're not thinking about it every day, so you know, it's just something you have to live with. And everyone else has other issues, so I try to remember that too. You know, maybe they have heart disease, or you know, so you know, everyone has something that sometimes they have to bear. So, anything else? good luck to you all. I know your exam's coming up. I understand that.
The last
part? Yay. You made it.
Thank you, George, as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.